ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I want you to imagine a dark and slightly sad possibility. A birthday without cake. Ah, the celebratory cake. A signifier of occasion. A symbol of time and caring. The effort to bake and decorate. A sweet delight. A token of love. But damn it, sometimes cake is sent to try us. Sometimes the culinary centrepiece of our celebrations can be a recipe for disaster.
It was a 34-degree day. By the time it was transported to the venue, it had started to lean over like the Leaning Tower of Pisa.
The amount of time that you will spend creating one of these cakes is enormous. I've tried making a few. I'm a terrible cake decorator.
Oh, tip truck cake. Bitch of a cake. Don't make it. Unless you're really desperate.
I'm Jonathan Green, and this is Every Bite from ABC Radio National. It's the show about food and the places where food, culture, science, and history collide. This week, the occasional cake. How we ice and slice our memories.
The most challenging cake I've had to make was a lifelike real size canine from Doctor Who.
The little robot dog.
A robot dog. This cake was for a friend. It took all night. I did not sleep. And it's very hard when you need to go to work on no sleep because you've just made a robot dog for your friend cake.
Christopher Tay is an acclaimed pastry chef and the author of the cookbook Modern Australian Baking. He's the founder of Black Star Pastry, world famous for its strawberry watermelon cake. He now runs Hearth in Sydney's Inner West. So what drives someone like Christopher, a man with four children and several businesses, to lose a night of sleep in the service of cake?
It kind of has a love language to it, which is why I love baking cakes. It's like an act of service to make someone a cake.
When did you first do that yourself?
I think I came to cake making a little bit late. I started as a savory chef, but I figured out that I much preferred going home smelling of, you know, sugar and rose petals and meringue instead of fish and garlic. So I was working in a French restaurant and we would have this one cake and it was iced in a way that would look like an 18th century French cake with piping, and that was terrifying. So I had to pipe perfectly all the way around and then pipe decorations and then write happy birthday. And I had to practice that at home before I could take it to work.
You could now do it in your sleep.
Yes, I can.
Let's talk wedding cakes, because that's the big cake in a lot of people's lives, is the cake they have at their wedding.
There is a lot of pressure making a wedding cake, let me tell you. You've got to design it, and it's meant to be a surprise on their wedding night. They come into the reception and they see it for the first time, hopefully. And that pressure to have it like meet their expectations and mark their special day is it's quite daunting, actually.
You ruined the surprise for your own wedding by making the cake yourself.
This was in the days before wedding cakes were actually nice to eat. And if you remember, they were covered in white plastic fondant and had sugar flowers made with metal wires. But I kind of bit off more than I could chew, and I was still putting the thing together just before I went to the church to get married.
Just describe the cake for me from the base up.
It was four layers tall because I wanted to feed everybody. It had plastic icing in a ribbon that was round all the way to the top, and on top were giant lilies made of sugar paste. I was told that lilies by my Indonesian family signified death, and that's what you had at funerals, but that's what my wife wanted, so she got that.
Was it a robust cake?
No, it wasn't, unfortunately. It was a 34-degree day. By the time it was transported to the venue, it had started to lean over like the Leaning Tower of Pisa. And while I was at the reception, I out of the side of my eye, I could just see it moving slowly, bit by bit by bit. So we propped it up, quickly cut it, and it actually tasted quite good.
Well, it was a bespoke wedding cake of your invention that made you rather famous. Tell us the story of that cake.
I had a friend ask me to make her wedding cake and to make it as creative as possible. And that's just the perfect brief when you get that. I could see the finished cake in my mind. It had two layers of cake, had strawberries on top, and that center layer was a red stripe.
So that could have been jam or something like that, but you had other plans.
Because my friend had asked me to be very creative, I decided to put a piece of fruit in the middle, watermelon, and I macerated it in rose water because fragrance is a really important part of how we taste. So the rose water made it very fragrant and it set off a international craze, that cake.
How did that happen?
Well, it was just part of the repertoire of the cake shop I was running, Black Star Pastry. And at one point, we just started to get people coming in with suitcases to come eat the cake. It was about the time when people were taking on social media, especially the visual on Instagram. And I really think that kicked off this trend of cake tourism, where people would go and travel just to have a piece of cake that they saw on the internet.
So at the height of that, how much of the strawberry watermelon cake were you making?
One tray of cake would have 60 portions and we would be making 100 trays of this cake on one day. So I had a team of 12 people just making this one cake. I was buying 3 pallets of watermelon a week. A truck would come up and we would unload the watermelons by hand. And then it would follow a production, much like making a car. One person would be chopping the watermelon, one person would be making the cake layers, one person would be whipping the cream, and it'd all come together at the end.
It's the price of fame.
Yeah. I never thought that would be what I was doing, but one day you look around and you've got a cake factory.
Do you still make that cake?
The strawberry watermelon cake is still the favourite cake of my kids. So when they have a birthday, they always say, "Dad, can you make that cake for me?" So I make it at home for my family.
What were the birthday cakes of your own childhood?
My mother and grandmother, they were great bakers. Every birthday, they would have a cake with this coffee extract. Always the same birthday cake, so that always signified a birthday. We also had the infamous Woman's Weekly birthday cake book, and so we had many cakes out of there, the swimming pool, the duck with the chip beak.
So even a master pastry chef like Christopher Tay had a formative encounter with the Australian Women's Weekly's 1980 Children's Birthday Cake Book. I'm sure you know it. It's got a red train cake on the cover, hauling a blue wagon of multicoloured popcorn. And if social media had been a thing in 1980, I'm sure the bright yellow rubber ducky cake with two crinkle-cut potato crisps serving as the beak, that would have broken the internet. So, whose idea was it to put potato chips on a birthday cake?
As soon as the crisps were there for the bill, I mean, it was a eureka moment. I remember Mrs. S saying, "But they're savoury, they're not sweet." "Oh, well, you know, whatever." We broke a lot of rules making these cakes. My name is Pamela Clark and I'm the author of the Women's Weekly Children's Birthday Cake Book. There's the tiger and the lion and the koala. There's a piano, a helicopter, racing cars, rockets. We racked our brains and tried to think of every thought any child has ever had about any cake. There was resistance. Some of the team and some of the bosses, they just didn't believe that the Children's Birthday Cake Book was a goer. So we basically talked our boss into doing this book. When someone had seen an idea, they'd go into the kitchen in amongst their other work and they'd make the cake. We'd call in Mrs. S, our food editor, cakes. And she'd get very excited and say, "Let's shoot it, little darling." They'd literally take a shot of the not very carefully made cake that was sitting on the kitchen bench. And if you look at the cakes carefully, you will see a lot of mistakes. Oh, tip truck cake, bitch of a cake, don't make it, unless you're really desperate. Mrs. S wanted a truck, and I was given the task of doing it. It was almost a feat of engineering. The weight of the top would just break all the cake. Don't go there. Glue the pages together. Forget it.
Pamela Clark, the former food editor of the Australian Women's Weekly and co-author of their classic children's birthday cake book, which has sold well over a million copies since its 1980 release. You're listening to Every Bite from ABC Radio National. These days, the children's birthday cake book seems to have become required reading for cake lovers and food historians well beyond Australia's borders.
Many different places have had a Bible that they look to. And it's interesting that you have this Australian Women's Weekly book, which has become such an iconic guide to creating cakes. It is known worldwide. I have a modern copy that I just picked up in a shop. And actually, I had the classic 1980s version before I started researching the book, because a colleague had told me about a hickory dickory dock cake that she made for her children. And I thought it sounded so fun that I'd gone and hunted out a secondhand copy.
Elisa Levine is a historian and amateur baker. She's from the UK. She's the author of Cake, A Slice of History. And as she explains in the book, cake was not always the readily available foodstuff that it is today.
Not at all. Cake would have been a very rare treat for most of the population for most of history. And that's because the key ingredients that we think of as characterising a cake today weren't in ready supply, but actually neither were the means to make them into a cake. So people might have better access to eggs and to butter because they were much more likely to live agriculturally. But they probably didn't have the equipment to turn it into anything like what we might think of today. So for most people, a cake would probably have been a shaped piece of bread, often baked on a hearthstone or under an upturned pot, or perhaps taken to a communal bakery. And it was only when people started to add more things to their bread dough, like perhaps an egg or a bit of butter if they had some left over, that it started to become richer. And then as they started to access means of sweetening, perhaps honey, later on dried fruit, and eventually sugar, that it started to become something like that sweet treat that we think of today.
So when do we see the arrival of that modern idea of the cake?
It's quite difficult to say. We start to see something like our modern day fruit cakes much earlier in the medieval period or earlier in Europe. And that's when international trade had started to open up. We'd had the Crusaders going overseas, bringing back things like dried fruits. And many more houses, large houses, might have a large oven where they were to do all of the household baking. And so cakes would go into the oven as it cooled down after the bread had been baked. But those cakes were heavily spiced, and so they'd be fantastically expensive to make. Lots of dried fruit, because everything was much heavier, the ingredients, the flour wasn't so refined, the dried fruit was very heavy. And so you could whisk the eggs as long as you wanted to, and people did for half an hour, beating both the butter and the eggs. It was never going to give you that lift and rise. And so people didn't really realise what eggs could do to a cake batter, because the eggs didn't really have the opportunity to do that in a heavy batter like that. So it was something sweet, and it was something very celebratory, often on an enormous scale. It might have 30, 40 eggs in these things, but it wasn't quite what we tend to think of today. That said, much earlier than that, the ancient Greeks and Romans were enjoying all sorts of cakes, which again were flavoured with local produce. So it might be local honey. They made them in all sorts of different shapes for all sorts of different occasions, and they certainly were celebratory as well. Probably also not much like we would think of today. They were sometimes fried. They didn't have that same light rise that we get from having delicate temperature control on our ovens and so on. But they were certainly thought of something that went with a big occasion, whether that was a drinking society or whether it was a wedding or a temple offering.
A cake for a drinking society. There's a thought to conjure with. let's turn to that idea of the celebratory. And I guess for most of us, if we think of that and cake, we immediately think of a birthday cake. That idea, apart from anything else, is dependent on knowing when your birthday was.
Absolutely. And that is something that we can't take for granted for most of our history, really. People didn't write down their birth dates. They didn't have any reason to. And so people had a rough idea of when they were born, but it would often be tied to some event. Do you remember when there was that storm, there was that famine? And so they were approximately 30 or approximately 40. And even when we do start to see records of people's ages, there's a lot of heaping around those decades. So you can't really have that many 30-year-olds and 40-year-olds in the population. People are rounding. And so for that reason, of course, they weren't really celebrating birthdays in the way that we do today, with a precise sense of how old they were. There was also a lot of superstition for children, because infant and child mortality was very high, around celebrating. And actually, a lot of the early traditions for birthday cakes were about navigating children through those difficult early years. The candle on the cake was often thought to be protective, to keep evil spirits at bay on that particular day if they did know the child's precise birthday. And then it became something much more joyful as we started to celebrate childhood in a different way, with lots more commercialized products and so on, and started to invest much more time and money in leisure activities with our children. And that, we think, started to happen around the 18th century in Europe.
At what point do we see the birthday cake as being a thing of annual routine?
Well, I would say that it starts in the 18th century. And again, that's because we see cakes becoming more recognisably modern at that stage. But when we start to think of an industry, then really we're looking at the early 20th century. And again, there's a whole host of things that start to coalesce. And a lot of that has to do with coming out of the World Wars, when people, again, austerity aside, started to have more money and more things, and the birth rate went up. And so people really started to invest in a culture of the angel in the home. That was a phrase that was used of the 19th century women in the home, but certainly we see it in the post-war period as well, where women are marketed this sense that staying at home and being a homemaker is the pinnacle of what they should be doing. And one of the things they spent their time doing was providing things like birthday cakes for children.
Did the typical cake types emerge?
Yes, and the further we come up to the modern day, the more diverse they become. So in the Victorian period and the early 20th century as well, cakes that are labelled as being for children in cookbooks tend to be very sturdy, because they're written with a real middle-class model of a child going away to boarding school. And so they were cakes that would keep well and travel well. They were often heavy. They were sometimes still yeasted, which was sort of a throwback to earlier models of cake. But then as we come into the 1940s, 1950s, we start to see much lighter, fluffier cakes. And really, they start to become a lot more about the icing and the decoration than about the cake themselves. It was kind of immaterial, really, what the cake itself was. And in fact, in the United States, and I think also in Australia, there's been a strong move towards actually making the cake is the least important bit. You could make that out of a cake mix, and then you invest all of your energy and your time into making it look beautiful.
Now, that's, of course, an intensely, it's almost a competitive performative activity.
Yes. And that's a word that's often used. And it makes it terribly stressful as well, because you're not only providing a cake, which people are going to eat and judge your ability to provide, but also you're going to be often, especially for a child, carrying it out into the party where the child is the star of the day. And if you haven't done your best job, perhaps compared to the child's friends' parents, then they're going to judge you. And of course, nobody is, and the child couldn't care less, as long as it's got candles on it and lots of sugar and they get to cut it and be a little star of their own cake party.
We assume that there's certain sort of homogenised and I guess a American-centric culture around many of these things, but I wonder how much the tradition of the birthday cake does vary country to country.
Enormously. So we think of a very light and fluffy, spongy cake, but no, other countries have a wide variety of different traditions, both in decoration and in the type of cake. And of course, I think because now tastes are so varied, people will make anything. And so in the same way that some couples no longer have a wedding cake at all, instead they have a tiered stack of cheeses, I think now anything goes with birthday cakes worldwide.
A tiered stack of cheeses?
Yeah, sorry. It's not traditional.
Since you bring it up, we must talk about the wedding cake. When do we start to see that cake in its traditional tiered form?
Well, the wedding cake, there are a number of recipes for things that authors call bride cake as far back as we have cookbooks in Europe. So we're talking probably 16th century. And they were back in these model of the huge, rich fruit cakes, but clearly did have a function at a bridal celebration because of their name. We don't see the big tiered cakes until the Victorian period. So Queen Victoria had a large round cake, but it was a single layer. By the time her daughter got married, that was a big tiered affair. And again, we can tie that in with conspicuous consumption, really, and also with changes in both fashion and cake technology. So as you'll know, a wedding cake has to be quite sturdy. So we're not really talking about the light, fluffy cakes at this stage. But what it did was create an aspirational image for the marriage. So they're very tall. It's almost like a third special member of the wedding party. They're white, echoing the whiteness of the bride's traditional gown. And then they could be very richly decorated. The public was intensely interested in the royal wedding. And so to have something so striking, which was so trend-setting, as in fact the royal family was in so many ways, to do with cultural history and relationships in the family. They popularized so many of our modern Christmas traditions as well. That was the moment that people then started to copy this very tall and ornate cake. But that wasn't until the end of the 19th century. Into wartime, of course, it shrank right back again. People didn't have the resources to put into something like a wedding cake. Many people had very small weddings. And very famously, a lot of the photos that couples would pose for during wartime marriages, the cake was actually not really there at all. It was substituted for a cardboard cutout to make it look as though they had the trappings. And then you might take the cardboard cutout away and there'd be this rather sad little fruitcake, which was all that they could afford their ingredients for at the time.
Oh dear, that's quite touchingly sad.
It is, yes. There's reminiscences of people being excited as childhood wedding guests thinking, I'm going to get to eat this amazing cake. And no.
It was cardboard. Elisa Levine, she's the author of Cake, A Slice of History. Of course, cakes don't just appear at weddings and birthday parties. There are Easter cakes, Christmas cakes, christening cakes, moon cakes. And in Australia, we might look forward to a democracy sausage on election day, but have you heard of the election cake?
It's dense, yeast, risen, enriched with eggs, lots of dried fruits. And it's much more like bread by today's standards than cakes. It's really not sweet enough. And then it's fortified with spirits like sweet wine or brandy and lots of spices. My name is Casey Highsmith, and I am a food scholar with a PhD in food history.
And in the electoral context in the United States, when would these cakes make an appearance?
So these would have been made, another phrase or another name for this category of cakes was great cakes, meaning that they were served for great occasions. So whenever we had elections early in the colonial days, white male landowners who could vote would leave their homes wherever they were in the countryside and travel into designated cities that were ready for voting because you had to vote in person. And they sometimes would bring their family and they'd come into these spaces where they'd be welcome into other homes or big kind of tavern settings. And there'd be lots of different feasts and things like that planned. And one of the things at these feasts would have been large election cakes, whether large in size or just large in quantity. And they would have been prepared for the men who came to vote, their families who were there to just be a part of the kind of celebration, and anyone else who was around.
As you say, men doing the voting, mm-hmm. women cooking the cakes.
Yeah. So women, you know, of course, couldn't vote. And there were other folks who couldn't vote as well. But this was one of the way that women had agency to kind of be a part of the electoral process. They might be in the same room that some of these conversations were happening before voting took place, kind of serving the tea, slicing the cake, you know, maybe mentioning a thing or two that they might be interested in, or at the very least, just being there, understanding and hearing all of this information that they technically weren't privy to, but then could take away and have conversations amongst other groups, other women, and kind of be a part of this larger process.
Is it in contemporary American elections still a feature, the election cake?
So every decade or so, the newspapers run wild with, you know, have you ever heard of the election cake? It's what our foremothers used to bake. And so they do a big piece about it. You know, every big election, you see this look back, this very nostalgic thing. And we didn't really see a whole lot until actually the previous Trump administration and the pandemic kind of created this perfect storm of frustrated people, especially women, and the pandemic where people were home learning to bake some for the very first time, especially with yeast. There was the whole sourdough movement. I don't know if that was as big in Australia as it was for us here in the States. And so it created this wonderful opportunity for folks to learn about this cake again and try it again. I don't think it was tasty enough for most people to start incorporating it every year or every election cycle, but at least it kind of came about again.
Are there red cakes and blue cakes? Are they a partisan thing?
They are now. So I think now more than ever, especially with the advent of social media and Instagram and these very visual media, we have folks taking things like the election cake, the concept, and really reinventing what can be considered an election cake, which I personally think anything can be an election cake. There's this history, but it can continue on in different ways. And so you do have people, especially now more than ever, really demonstrating their partisan views, either for one party or another, one candidate or another, or about specific issues ranging from immigration to reproductive health care. So really the sky's the limit for how you want your election cake to look and what message you want it to say.
Changing the world one cake at a time.
That's the hope.
If it's special, it has a cake. Or maybe it's the cake that makes the day special. Either way, it's hardly an occasion without one. For the last word, the icing, if you like, here's Christopher Tay.
The cake seems to be part of that pinnacle of the birthday experience, and it comes as a whole and then is cut by the birthday person and then distributed to all the guests. And all at once, we share the same flavors and textures in our mouth. And I think that's why it's such an integral part of a birthday gathering.
That's so good. I hadn't thought of the sharing. That's what it is capable of doing, is being spread around the room.
Yes. I think it also ties into our human, somewhere in evolution, we saved all the best bits of what we'd gathered and found and kept them for special occasions. I think birthdays were later, probably religious festivals, and we put them all into one dish and we'd put all our favourite dried berries and fats in it and serve it up for special festivals. And I think there's a part of us that still wants to experience that, that's still drawn to that.
Long live the cake.
Every Bite is your weekly journey to the places where food, culture, science and history collide. Every Bite tells a story. And thanks to our guests, Christopher Tay, Alyssa Levine and Casey Highsmith. The interview with Pamela Clark was recorded by Tall Story Films. You can hear us on ABC Radio National or anytime on the ABC Listen app, and share us around. Think of us as a cake. If you enjoy our program and are listening somewhere, you can leave a review. Well, please do. Giving us 5 stars helps new listeners find us. And we'd love to hear your thoughts about the show. Email us at everybite, or one word, at abc.net.au. Everybite at abc.net.au. Every Bite is made on Wurundjeri country and produced by Kim Jurek. I'm Jonathan Green.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.